this week in the markets. The Dow Jones Industrials recorded the best weekly close of the year on this Good Friday. Well, welcome back, everyone, and happy Easter weekend on another GoldSeek.com radio episode with your host, Chris Waltzek, here on this Season 14, Episode 692. Well, Harry S. Dent Jr. returns with fresh insights on the markets. He says U.S. equities are set for record highs, thanks in no small part to $16 trillion in new global monetary stimulus. He expects the markets, as we do here, to continue higher and reach a crescendo. He's looking for NASDAQ 10,000. That's about, well, that's double the dot-com peak of the year 2000. And he's got great news for Bitcoin aficionados. He's looking for $32,000 Bitcoin within a year. But he does toss in the proviso, if U.S. shares experience a runaway bull market. And I'd certainly take that number with rather large grain of salt. We do agree, though, that every portfolio can benefit from at least a 10% precious metal life jacket. And we also think a 1% at least holding in cryptocurrencies is advisable, especially now that some states are accepting cryptos for tax payment purposes, just like gold and silver. What I'm looking for here is for a key central bank like either Moscow or Beijing to announce, or something similar to Venezuela, which obviously created its own petro-based cryptos. I'm waiting for one of these central bankers to announce they're accumulating in their currency reserves, not just gold and silver, but they're adding maybe palladium and Bitcoin or Ethereum or another basket of cryptos. At that moment, I think it will ignite the next leg higher in the cryptos, and I think it will be an exciting time. But even without that, the cryptos can stand on their own, because where I think many investors could be missing the boat here, cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, they're not just currencies. It's kind of a misnomer, cryptocurrency. I like to think of them as crypto assets. Of course, these assets are transforming businesses, business transactions, real estate, education, insurance. You know, the sky is really the limit. You can innovative technology that offers an array of use cases. We're seeing Bitcoin forks that permit embedding of contracts and images. And we're now running a fundraiser here this weekend at GoldSeek, offering some NASA images that have been cleaned up, revealing information that CNN actually highlighted these images that we are embedding here. And they couldn't make heads or tail of the images. They said, we think there might be something here, but we're not sure. So we took considerable time and effort, cleaned up many of these images, and revealed some, agree, stunning images that from the NASA JPL Curiosity rover that sent these images 401 million miles back to Earth, okay, a few years ago, embedding them in a Bitcoin fork, Bitcoin SV. If you'd like to support the show, all you've got to do is sign up for an annual newsletter subscription. You get the weekly updates. One of these embedded coins, tokens, a Bitcoin fork token, a unique image tied and embedded to, with the timestamp, the blockchain that's sent directly to your wallet. So don't miss out on this opportunity to not only support the show, but get involved in the digital asset revolution. Pick up a piece of artwork that's unique. Physicist Stanton Friedman makes his show debut. Really honored to have him on the show. Former classmate of Carl Sagan, spent 14 years designing fusion and fission propulsion systems for space travel in top secret laboratories. One of these NASA nuclear engines, the year I was born, was stronger than the Hoover Dam, actually twice as strong, and only 8 feet in diameter. In other words, for 50 years approximately, we've had the power to go to the stars, to approach the speed of light. He makes what I thought was a very interesting comment, that it only takes 1G acceleration per day, 1G acceleration per day to approach the speed of light in just a year, which means that we have stars, one in particular, interesting star, that's only 4.5 light years away, using his technology that now is 50 years old. Who knows what we have now? You could take a very small Curiosity-like rover to the star systems in just a few years, and then receive the images, photos, and audio in just a few more years, you know, at the speed of light. There is one planet for every star in the universe. And there's approximately 200 billion stars just in our local galaxy and 200 billion galaxies. Now do the math on that. What's 200 billion times 200 billion? Some of which likely have conditions similar to the Earth. And we'd like for you to call in the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. You'll need our extension number, 514049. 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. Please jot this down in a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone. We'd like to hear your comments. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly sunny skies persisted over the precious metal sector this week as investors once again cheered better than expected U.S. economic numbers as well as those with one of our top trading partners. At Friday's closing bell, the precious metals were a bit mixed this week. We saw gold off just $19, finishing at around $1,273. Silver finished at around break even, near $15, while the XAU shares were off 4% at 73. Black gold added a fractional amount, finishing at 64. But palladium shone brightly, adding $48, finishing at 1400. Platinum picked up $5 at 904. The top story moving the markets, the U.S. dollar spiked higher this Thursday on news of global economic growth as investors sought the greenback over the euro currency, following weak manufacturing data out of Europe and robust U.S. retail sales, which increased by the most in a year and a half in March. According to the Commerce Department, the sales numbers bumped higher by 1.6%. That's the fastest rate in over a decade, indicating U.S. economic growth remains solid despite strong protests from many mainstream sources. Adding to the strong domestic economic thesis, the latest employment numbers from the Labor Department showed the best figure in 50 years. In related news, we continue to keep a close eye on the Fed Fund futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which indicates policymakers could begin a fresh round of QE within a year or so. The odds of a rate hike in the last two Fed Funds contracts at the CME remain quite low, and investors are anticipating more dovish Fed moves. Bottom line, precious metals. Well, the fundamental picture for the metals remains solid with signs of strong economic growth and talk of inflationary measures from the EU ministers to bolster their ailing economy led to strength in the US dollar, as well as our good numbers here and that in China, which could bode well in the mid to longer term for the precious metals, with the proviso that the strong dollar looks like it could rally in coming weeks might give us a temporary consolidation mode. I still like at least 10% as a safety net in every portfolio, at least 1% of the cryptos as a great beta diversification tool. Moving on to Wall Street, mostly sunny skies, partly sunny skies were seen over the New York Stock Exchange as investors favored the blue chip companies this week over the high tech. By Friday's closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow picked up 147, ending at 26,559. Meanwhile, the S&P was off 2 points at 2905, and the NASDAQ briefly jumped above 8,000, closing just below it this week. Meanwhile, investors continue to keep at least one eye on the United States and China as they attempt to resolve the trade dispute. Washington and Beijing are expected to continue working on negotiations through June, according to a Wall Street Journal report. Unlike the EU, China's economic growth in the first quarter remains strong at 6.4%. That was better than expected by economic forecasts of only 6.3% expansion. The news was seen as a big positive for palladium, as strong auto manufacturing in China will likely continue to keep demand for the metal elevated within its supply deficit. Plus, according to one media source, platinum could become more desirable and in higher demand as diesel engine demand dropped off, which subdued Saman temporarily, but that could turn around as platinum is adopted as an alternative to palladium by auto manufacturers. A substitute good for platinum, you might. Meanwhile, the enthusiasm over the IPO, over the first day IPO Pinterest, caught the attention of CNBC's Mad Money Jim Cramer. The $19 opening IPO price, first day of trading, shot up to 24, more than a 28% gain. Pinterest is trading at 21 times its 2018 sales. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, the USA Today Greed to Fear Index remains at an elevated level, but it doesn't seem too overbought yet. The technical view is a bit mixed here. The Dow seems poised to break out to new highs, perhaps, in the coming weeks, while the S&P and the NASDAQ are somewhat in consolidation mode, maybe building up steam for the next breakout. I wouldn't at all be surprised to see a new assault on new highs later this year. Coming up after the break, more Goldseek.
It's just a pleasure to welcome nuclear physicist and lecturer Stanton Friedman to the show. He spent over 14 years as a physicist with GE, GM, Westinghouse, and many others. It's just a real honor to have him on the show with us today. Hello, sir.
Hi.
Can you please just give us perhaps what you're working on currently and any other findings you'd like to share today?
Well, I'm working on getting older. I'm 84, so... As you know, the original civilian investigator, the Roswell incident, and I've announced my retirement. I started that back in the 70s, incidentally. I stumbled across that. Somebody told me the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Oh, why is that? His next sentence changed my life, this informant. He handled wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in. He was in the military. What? Out of the blue. That's the Roswell incident. Jesse was the intelligence officer at the Roswell Army Airfield in New Mexico. That was in the 70s, mind you. I'm thinking about two more books. I've already written several. The thing is that the world has changed. I've been at this. I just wrote a paper for the Mutual UFO Network Annual Symposium. 60 years of ufology. Gee, that makes me feel old. Well, 60 years is a long time, and the world has changed. One of the big changes is our understanding of our place in the local neighborhood, if you will. We used to think when Frank Drake talked about searching for extraterrestrial intelligence in 1961, he talked there might be 8,000 places out there where there's life. And now probably more like 100 billion. What we didn't know then was that in our neighborhood, if you will, there is an average of more than one planet per star. So in the Milky Way galaxy, that's over 100 billion planets. So the notion that here we are special on top of the heap in one of the few places where there might be life, they're all over the place out there. It's not surprising that they're visiting here partly out of self-interest. I presume every civilization is concerned about preventing invasions from outsiders. You know, whether you're a colony in the United States in 1650 or where we are now, I'm a proponent of several notions that I've concluded after all these years of study. One is the evidence is overwhelming that Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. Some UFOs, underline the sum 37 times, are alien origin. And what I can bring to that argument, incidentally, is that I worked on far-out propulsion systems. The first response used to be, well, you can't get here from there, Stan. What are you talking about? But I worked on fission rockets, fusion rockets, nuclear power plants for space, and you can get here from there. Is it easy? No. Can I build it in my garage? No. But it's doable. And it's exciting to realize that we're latecomers. You know, there was a time, 1650, we thought the world was created, Bishop Usher said so, in 4004 B.C., 6,000 years old. And now we say, well, it's over 4 billion years old, Stan. Plenty of time for others to have gotten started and for colonization and migration. And let's hope that the guys coming here, and gals too, I suppose, they have demonstrated that a civilization can last a while. And people say, well, Stan, why would they come here and not land on the White House lawn? And I'd have to say, A, it's a no-fly zone, and B, it's nice to think they'd want to come here to visit with us, but look at how we behave. We're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. The thing about nuclear weapons is not only that they're destructive, but they indicate a control of a technology that allows us to go out there if we want to spend the time and money and effort. And if I were an alien, I'd worry about Earthlings coming out there, frankly. We're not nice guys. Wars on Earth. Couldn't call us nice guys.
Have you perhaps read any of the latest literature from NASA? One of the ways to get around, I'm sure you could imagine, the mass issue that you deal with as you approach very high speed, tenth of the speed of light, you've obviously become too heavy too quickly, too massive. They're proposing incredibly tiny AI-controlled ships to Alpha Centauri and beyond. And these are apparently even off the, you know, the drawing board.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in the systems such as the ones I worked on, nuclear fission propulsion for deep space travel, nuclear fusion propulsion, that's what goes on in the sun. I think if you want to move, I want to move people. And so I worked on systems. We successfully tested a nuclear rocket engine back in 1969, less than 8 feet in diameter. Three different companies tested them, Aerojet General, where I worked, Westinghouse Astronuclear, and Los Alamos. And we tested, well, the biggest one, Los Alamos, tested 4,000 megawatts. That's less than 8 feet in diameter. That's twice the power of Hoover Dam, incidentally, which is just a little bit larger than 8 feet in diameter. So we know that most of the energy in the universe is produced by nuclear fusion. And I worked on a study of fusion propulsion for deep space travel way back in 1962. And our conclusion was, if you got the dough, you can go. So it's a crazy notion that we're limited to either really far out exotic or stuck here on planet Earth.
Do you suspect that our authorities may have had secret, you know, under the table projects?
Well, I think there's a chance, and I'm certainly one who says you can keep secrets. I had a clearance for 14 years, and that's not just idle imagination. On the other hand, I think we'd see more evidence of it. What are you going to do with it? Going to the stars is a big deal. And I don't think anybody out there would want us there. We're a primitive society. Our major activity is tribal warfare. Is that an advanced civilization? You know, I have trouble with that.
Do you think maybe we just haven't reached, you know, the next level, like Michio Kaku and some of these forward-thinking scientists have proposed that, you know, you have to sort of move beyond that tribal warfare to a higher energy, Dyson spheres and things like that?
Yes, we've got to advance beyond that. And I'm sure when I say nuclear fusion would be my choice for deep space travel, it's not because I think we'll never find anything better. One of my mottos is the technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You've got to change how you do things. On the other hand, almost all the energy in the universe is produced by nuclear fusion. That's what goes on in the stars. I mean, 100 years ago, we said, the sun is a mass of burning gas. Hardly. Burning, chemical burning, is not the same as nuclear fusion by a factor of millions, you know. So I think we're the Johnny-come-latelys in the neighborhood. And we don't, our technology is moving along, but we don't seem to have the sociology, if I can put it that way. I'm an optimist. I think we can lick these problems. I don't think the aliens are going to come along and give us technology. On the other hand, I think what they will do is keep us from taking our brand of friendship out there.
Do you care then to step outside the box and give us the Stanton Friedman view of the next 30 years?
By 30 years, I think we on this planet will have touched all the bases and figured out a way to live with the other civilizations on the planet. We're not doing a great job of it. On the other hand, there hasn't been a big war, which is really quite remarkable. Now, you could say it's mutually assured destruction, and if that's what it takes, okay, I'll live with that. But I think our leadership has recognized that being nasty to other people doesn't get you very far past a certain point. And we're not going to take what they have. And knowing that there are aliens coming here who obviously don't want us to join them as equals, because we're not. You know, they've learned to live at peace with each other, presumably for a very long time. We haven't. But I'm an optimist. I've got a great-grandson, and I think by the time he grows up, I think we will have learned some important lessons here. One of them is to use our technology for the benefit of mankind. Two is to recognize that the borders really don't mean a lot. We're all Earthlings. It's about time we started thinking in those terms and saying, instead of saying, I'm Russian, I'm American, I'm Greek, I'm Peruvian, whatever. I mean, that's a lesson that takes a while to learn these lessons. But we've come a long way. Look back 300 years. Times have changed.
You know, we are more of a global village. We also have the interconnectivity of the global World Wide Web, which sort of ties in with your idea of a borderless society. Maybe that we may eventually receive a signal from off-world and maybe even communications.
Well, Carl and I were classmates for 3 years at the University of Chicago, and we grew up in adjacent towns in New Jersey. And we disagreed about UFOs, but I think we are moving toward a planetary viewpoint, partly because of the advances in technology, all those satellites and stuff like that. From a satellite, the boundaries don't show up as you can't go past this point, you know. So I'm an optimist. I think that the people on this planet, the management, if you will, recognize that, yes, we're capable, should we choose to do so, of destroying ourselves. We got an H-bomb represents a lot of energy, and you can see the progress, if I can put that in quotes. Big bomb in World War II is a 10-ton blockbuster, the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Wow! Okay, the first atomic bomb represented like 15,000 tons of dynamite. The first H-bomb was 10 million tons, and the Russians have tested one that was like 58 million tons of dynamite. So you don't need any more energy than that to make a heck of a mess out of the place. What we haven't done is figure out good ways to use it for the benefit of our society. But I'm an optimist. I think we're moving in that direction. I think young people today recognize that they're Earthlings, partly because of all the satellites and stuff. And so I'm an optimist. I think my great-grandson will grow up in a much better world. Not that we have thrown out the capability of destroying ourselves, but we're a bit more reasonable about how we use those capabilities. So I'm an optimist. I'm looking forward to getting old. I'm only 84. I got plenty of time to grow old. And I'm looking forward to seeing a world more settled in an Earthling orientation. That's what it takes to be an optimist.
I don't know if you've been following what's coming out of CERN in recent years, but they've discovered a subatomic particle they're calling a strangelet, which has the potential, according to some theoretical physicists, to be the next quantum leap higher beyond fission.
Yeah, I think progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. And the crazy thing is, the smaller you get in the scale of the system you're looking at, the more energy that's involved per particle. Now, don't ask me why that is. That's how God made the universe. You know, I think we will learn how to use that to do things like interstellar travel. I mean, at 1G acceleration, it takes less than a year to get to the speed of light. And people look at me, what? I say, yeah, that's right. Not 10 years, not 100 years, less than a year. People want half an Einstein. They forget the other half. Not only the speed of light is a limit, but time slows down as you go faster. And don't ask me why. I don't know why. But
any other literature you'd like to direct our listeners to?
My books are still available, and they can see you order all of them, and I autograph all the stuff I send out at www.stantonfriedman.com. I would recommend people do their homework and recognize it's a big universe, it's an old universe, we're a small part of it, we got a ways to go before we rule the roost. But I'm still an optimist. I think, as I said, my great-grandson will be in great shape when he grows up.
That's remarkable. Great-grandson. I have two boys of my own, but I can't imagine being a great-grandfather and still being so productive. Stanton Friedman, thank you.
You're very welcome.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premium. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome Harry Estend Jr., head of an economic research and forecasting company. Welcome back.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Wanted to jump right into this situation in Puerto Rico. You're having trouble with electricity.
Great. It's a pleasure to welcome back Harry Estend Jr. to the show.
Nice to be back, Chris.
You know, a lot has happened since we've had you on the show. Big sea change in rates by the Federal Reserve, suddenly looking a bit more dovish while their colleagues in the EU and other central bankers are more hawkish. What are the implications for the markets?
The U.S. has been the only country making new highs in major indices in late 2018. And as we move into 2019, I see kind of like the perfect combo, partly globally, but more so for the U.S., where growth is slowed enough globally for the Fed to back off, as you just said, and then stop raising rates and slow down and selling off its bond stash, which you know, the markets love. You know, the China trade deal is supposed to come any day now, so the markets are holding up for that. So we had a big correction late last year, but one of the things I do, Chris, because, I mean, I've really studied bubbles in the last 10 years because it's really become the theme. We're in the greatest bubble in history, extended by massive money printing. We're up to now $16 trillion of money printing by all the central banks. And then on top of that, $1.5 trillion of tax cuts from Trump in the U.S. only. Again, we're still going stronger in the stock markets and our economy's holding up a little better than Europe and China and stuff. I see this bubble going up. I think we're going to see this bubble last until late this year, and the final phase should be the strongest. I mean, bubbles go out with a bang, not a whimper. So I'm looking at the NASDAQ by the end of this year, very early next year, could be as high as 10,000, the Dow as high as 33,000, and then this thing blows. I mean, because friends are weakening. Real estate is weakening. I'm on my third trip to Australia in a little over a year because their real estate market's cracking, and it's been the most stellar real estate market in the developed world outside of China. So this is happening. You can't keep a bubble going forever, but everything is still favoring the bubble here, and this bounce back from late December says to me, you know, we'd have to see new highs by the summer, but I think you are going to see new highs, and then I think it's going to go at least till the fall, maybe early next year at the latest. So I think we got one more big bubble, And so, you know, I've been bubble fighter, but I'm like, ever since Trump got elected and was saying we're going to cut taxes, I'm like, you can't fight that. Better. That'd be better than QE for this.
You talk about bubbles, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, a decade, because very few people in the mainstream have really woken up to is how money printing you referred to, how that's changed. It used to be a printing press. You know, we had coinage. Then we moved to paper. Let's call that derivative 1.0. Then we went from that derivative 1.0 to the Greenspan era, where you suddenly have this sort of digital behind the scenes markets opening up. Then we go to maybe 3 or 4.0 with credit default swaps, you know, mortgage-backed securities, things of that nature. Options, derivatives, derivatives on futures. I mean, it seems to me that we're reaching a crescendo of liquidity, add in the blockchain. So give us an idea of how this crack-up boom might wrap up. I mean, is it going to be the epic blow-off that folks are looking for, or might it just end in a whimper?
Yeah, that's what I see, epic blow-off. The first shot we had of that, after Trump got elected, in late 2016, when we just said, look, you got to be bullish here. You know, we're in that final stage, and it's hard to tell. That can last years. Now, here we are with all this happening, and it's still favorable for the bubbles. And crypto, I mean, in the tech bubble in the 90s, that's what I call a real bubble, when the fundamentals were great, internet moving mainstream, big technology explosion, baby boomers in their strongest years of spending, even though they weren't going to peak until 2007. That was a real bubble exaggerated by strong fundamental trends. This is happening. This bubble's happening with weakening demographic trends, the worst growth. Here's a great statistic, Chris, and we haven't even hit the peak of the crisis yet and the worst of what I see in the winter season. From 2007, the top, demographically, through 2018, cumulative real GDP growth was 19%. Well, you know, from the top in 1929 through the Great Depression in 1940 by the classic bottom people call, same 11 years, 20% real GDP growth. We've had a winter season, the lowest growth in U.S. history, now even lower than the 30s, wow, we have this great bubble in stock that is totally disconnected. I've got my classic spending wave that I've shown for, you know, 30 years now. And basically it worked until 2009, including the top and the downturn and what looked like was going to be the next Great Depression or breakdown of the financial system. And then, well, nope, we'll just print trillions of dollars and offset that. And now it's $16 trillion and rising and tax cuts and all this sort of stuff. So this has created an artificial bubble, which makes it more dangerous. This has, I mean, again, the stock market adjusted for inflation compared to my spending wave, which was the best indicator I've ever had, continues to work around the world, is now the stocks are more than double what they should be, which means they're the most overvalued compared to fundamentals in history. And it's all this stuff, like you're saying, it's all speculation, all cheap money. You know that almost all, since 2009 and QE, almost all the net, like over 90% of net buying of stocks has come from corporations buying back their own stock. It has not come from institutional investors who've been selling more than buying. Retail investors have been neutral and foreign investors have been slightly positive and small. It's all been buybacks funneled by cheap money in this artificial bubble that just like, okay. And so I always tell people recommending the tech stocks for everybody to buy when you ride with them. Now it's the largest corporations are the dumb money. They are buying overvalued stocks at the highest prices in history at the top of the market, using their cash flow to do that or borrowing, even worse. And then when the things crash, they're going to need that cash flow to survive the shakeout. And then they're going to be saying, where's the money we need? And why aren't you buying our stock now that they're down 70, 80, 90% like they were in the early 30s? So this is going to look like the stupidest thing in history. But right now, looks like the thing to do for corporations. Earnings are growing very slow, so goose your earnings per share by reducing the shares dramatically. And the Fed keeps issuing record debt. How do they float that? How do they afford it? They push interest rates down and they buy their own bonds to absorb the float. And then corporations turn around and buy their own stocks with cheap money and artificial cash. I mean, this is the craziest thing in history. And that's why it's just been my biggest challenge. I mean, we're very good at measuring and projecting fundamental cycles, including the commodity cycle and things like gold and commodity. But this is now central banks have taken over the free market system and just say, we're just going to grow. And you know how we're growing? We're just growing by speculation. The rich get richer. It's speculation. At least those people who may only be 20% of the economy, or they're 50% of spending, and they keep the economy going and corporations keep going. You know, this is crazy. It's not going to last. But, you know, I've had to adjust my cycles. You know, I've had to really adjust for saying, well, yeah, but this is the reality. Governments are going to push until it blows. And I say it's going to blow not yet, late this year, early next year is my best forecast from all of my cycles and from everything I can see on how things are deteriorating as they keep pumping this bubble up. There's a point where it just blows of its own extreme.
You brought up 1999. I was there. I started to cut my teeth as an analyst. You might say in the middle of the 1999 bubble. I mean, all you had to do was put a .com behind a name. And before you knew it, it tripled in value overnight. But you know, one of the hallmarks of that period was the retail investor came back into the market in a big way. Everywhere you went, somebody had a hot .com pick. I see a nervous retail investor, maybe one of the signs we should watch out for when your cycle peak that you're looking for comes to pass, a return to that almost ebullient, frothy level.
Yeah, there's two things. One thing that's different this time, this is now the third major bubble in a row. That bubble burst, you know, late 90s and early 2000, and then more modest bubble, 2007, and then a deeper burst. And now the biggest bubble yet and the most pervasive, and it's going to – I mean, retail investors have been thrown around since basically the late 1990s. The last time it was just one bubble, 29, and burst. And, of course, everybody, the longer something goes up, the more Joe Public jumps in. That's why in the late 90s. This time they are more cautious because people just don't know what to think. And you also see, pretty obvious to anybody with half a brain, this governments are just pumping this up. They are printing out of thin air, throwing it into this financial system, and now Trump is giving tax rebates to corporations when they have the highest profits as a percentage of GDP in all of history. Like they really need this. It's just anything to keep this bubble going, because you can't get Homer Simpson to spend more because they have peaked demographically. You can't get spend much more because their wages haven't gone up, or they've been down in real terms since 2000. So the only way is just to keep pumping up stocks and financial assets and corporations and keep it going at a level that at least feeds the richest people. And they, of course, spend money on everything from yachts to high-end restaurants, and it keeps the economy going enough. But again, who cares for the stock market? Profits have gone up. Earnings per share have gone up 119% faster than actual corporate earnings because of this stock buyback. That's just total artificial bubble going to burst. And again, I tell people bubbles always burst. I don't care whether it's supply or demand causing it. Australia, I've told them, yes, you've got better demographics than us. You know, all these advantages, but your real estate's the most overvalued in the developed world, and it's out of affordability, and it's going to break from its own. And that's what's happening. Australia, just like 2006, our real estate started to slow down, fall, and get in trouble without a recession 2 years before the stock market peaked and the recession started in early 2006. Well, that's what's happened in Australia. Their real estate is falling since mid-2017. They're going to be in a recession by 2020, and they've got good demographics where we don't. So this is bubbles defeat themselves, but man, this one has been off the charts on how long it can go because it's had so much support from governments. Are do or die on this, and they're just going to do this until they die. Then they're going to look like, and so the corporate managers. I think that these retail investors will jump in more at the end, but you know, they may never fully because they've already been whacked twice. Retail investors in China got whacked harder on the second bubble than the first one because the government encouraged margin buying in China to help offset the real estate bubble, which they were trying to taper down some. So they encouraged speculation. And retail investors in China got slaughtered in the 2015 second bubble burst in China. So I think retail investors have just been beat up, and they may never come back fully.
One thing that I'd like to toss into the ring here that I haven't read anywhere, really even in the blogosphere yet, although I'm sure many folks are at least ruminating on the idea, corporate buybacks. Remember, by the way, in the late 90s, that was huge too. I mean, they were floating. You might recall those secondary offerings, they had the IPOs, but then they were just dumping as much of their shares on the market and the market couldn't get enough of it. Well, today, corporations can't get enough of their own shares. The executives go without a salary. These days, their income is highly dependent upon those stock options. So if you have shares that are flying higher, hey, let's bump them up a little more. Starting to sag? Well, we'll buy back some shares, decrease float, increase demand, voila, higher prices. The only problem with this magic trick, the free money train sort of left the station as rates moved higher. Now there's talk the Fed might start a rating cycle. I know you're looking for an end of this bubble. What would you say to the hypothesis that if they do drop rates significantly, that decrease the cost of borrowing of our corporations and they could buy even more of their shares back?
Yeah, I think that's why, I mean, I'm just looking at the charts, and I look for the first bubble. One of the things I know about bubbles, and this is very important because that's my only defense for my subscribers, crash, and in the average of the last six major stock bubbles in the last century, 42% crash in the first 2.6 months. The most extreme was 29, late 29, where you saw 40%. In 2.3 months. And of course, Bitcoin was 69% in a month and a half, a more extreme bubble. That's the only way you know. So when there starts to be a correction, like in early 2018, I look at that correction and say, does this have the trajectory like 29 or early 2000 where it's going to be a big crash? And no, they didn't. So I had to tell my subscribers like in, March 2018, sorry, that looked like a bubble top, but it's not acting like a bubble top, so it's a correction, and the same thing in late 2018. So the only way to sense that is when we do finally start to see a correction, does it have that sort of trajectory? The markets look to me like this is the first wave up, with two more coming for a five-wave Elliott wave in this final bubble, and this first wave was pretty dramatic and hasn't even corrected yet. After it corrects, we should see another wave at least that strong up, and then another one after that. I mean, I tell you that my targets from a lot of angles, close to 10,000 on the NASDAQ, that's still a lot of upside. So all of this, you get some type of trade deal with China, which isn't going to last, but they need this, and there's some type of hokey trade deal. Okay, the markets love that. They're already expecting that. And maybe the Fed actually, instead of just not raising rates, actually talks about lowering them or lowers them a little bit, or stop selling bonds, easing the Fed gives, because they're the only ones that are tightening significantly in the world. Japan's still printing like crazy, and Europe was going to taper, but they've backed off with this slow economy. So if the Fed gets any more accommodative, that's just another reason for this stock market to run. And, in a bubble, the market ignores risk, and there's all types of political and financial risk, just like there were before. The market's going to ignore them, and all it needs is any good news. And so I think this is just part of how the NASDAQ gets to 10,000 in the next several months. And, by the way, I think Bitcoin, if stocks have another bubble, Bitcoin is a slam dunk to go to new highs. And I'm projecting 32,000 comparing to the early internet bubble, that Bitcoin could be at 32,000 within the next year. So we just get one great bubble. And then, of course, bubbles get extreme and they burst. I mean, because there's a point where the smart money, our measure of the smart money that we get from Bloomberg is already saying the smart money has not been buying the stock market since the early January 2018 peak. It's corporations buying their own stock that's still driving this. So this just goes until it blows. And then when it blows, I think, that first 40% plus crash in a few months is going to lose a lot of credibility for this whole bubble, for the central banks and everybody.
Firstly, I agree with your assessment that when this thing implodes, there's not going to be a lot of time to find the exit. Similar to what we saw, about, let's say, 8 months ago with that market swoon. But, you can't help but notice, Harry S. Dent Jr., that we've had quite a comeback from those lows. So the market resiliency, that speaks volumes.
Crack like it's been a bubble market. It hasn't been fazed by that correction. And again, The bubble does not get phased until you have a 30 to 50% correction, a 20% correction in late 98 before the last thrust like this. You know, the tech stocks were down 34% instead of just 24% recently, and then they turned around and went up higher than ever. So it takes more than we've seen to now. This market is still thinking we're up. The Fed's got it back. The Fed's going to get more accommodative. We're going to get tied a trade deal. Everything's okay. Trump's pro-business. The stocks are not phased. You're right. This rally says, I want to go up to me.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask for your thoughts on the precious metals sector. Higher stocks doesn't typically translate into great news for commodities. There's a higher correlation to the U.S. dollar. But the risk-on trade doesn't usually work to the benefit of the more safe haven trade. So give us your thoughts. Are you looking for maybe some of the inflationary aspects to spill over?
Yeah, I have changed pretty substantially. First of all, when gold did hit that 1,050 level in late 2015, I said, look, this is oversold. This is due. I mean, this is like a major way down, but it's due for a major bounce. And our target was around 1,400. Well, we've gotten back near there. Gold could still go back and break up to, you know, somewhat above 1,400 or so. But that's kind of the limit I see. Because ultimately, when this thing turns down, it's going to be deflationary again and meltdown, and that's not good for gold. Gold does like inflation, and inflation is a little higher now, and that's one thing that can give gold some buoyancy in the near term. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it go up some higher. And I used to say gold could go down more. My bottom line target now for gold, since it has gold and cryptos, I have a bubble model for all of these things, stocks, commodities, real estate now. They've all followed them, upside and downside, where they've gone that far. Gold did not go down as much as it should have. It went up like a bubble. It did not go down as much. Neither did crypto, which is why I still think there's some buoyancy in both here. But ultimately, in a downturn, I think they both go down. I speak at crypto conferences now, and the crypto community is on this four-year. We get a bubble every 4 years. They think it's going to be 50,000 by 2021. I think you get a final quick bubble into late this year, and then crypto goes down 95%, and that's when you know the bubble's over there. And then you get a long-term boom like the internet had. And that same thing, I see gold maybe going up some, but then going down in the crash because of deflation. And then I see a big long-term, probably the best commodity boom in history, including gold, as emerging countries dominate the world. And guess what's gold the most? China and India spend the most money per capita income on gold. And so I think the next commodity boom, which would be from about 2023 to 2039 on my 30-year cycle, we'll see gold go from maybe 700 if it gets that low. It might even hold at 1,000 because it is holding up better than all the other commodities. But that's when gold could go to 4,000 or 5,000 or something. I wouldn't doubt that at all. But I'm neutral on gold near term, bearish the next few years, and then gold would be one of the first things I'd love to buy. We have a global crash of commodity stocks, real estate, everything but high quality bonds. And again, I found this in this crash, especially 2008 and now, that the safe haven really is more the U.S. dollar and the highest quality bonds. And that was also the case in the Great Depression. And gold was harder to measure because they kind of froze it and did all the stuff. But clearly in 2008, when things melted down, the U.S. dollar went up and the highest quality bonds did well. And in the Great Depression, the only thing that long-term treasuries and AAA corporates basically doubled in value dividends in the 30s when everything else went down and took a long time to get back. So that was really that's the safe haven I'm looking for. I'm looking at gold for playing the next long-term commodity rally. And the metals, gold, not just this, but all metals do better because they are much more limited than agriculture and cattle and sheep and stuff. That's stuff you can always expand. You can't expand the supply of gold and metals nearly as easily. So be a big on gold.
A little more difficult to move a large number of sheep across borders and from town to town, you know. And again, I don't want to draw too many eye rolls from my regular listeners, but clearly we love that 5 to 10% core holding of the precious metals in every portfolio. We never know when there's going to be a Venezuela or Argentina-style event or a Central Europe, and there's just been so many others. Even Russia, you know, a couple of years ago saw the price of oil and gold explode in value simply because of currency issues. And I think you kind of alluded to that eventually the end game is a systemic currency implosion. We just have no idea what they're going to do to hold off on that day of reckoning. Final thoughts then on maybe the next 3 months.
Well, I think it's crucial. If we're going to have this final bubble on the trajectory it's on right now, we should have a correction here over the next couple of weeks, maybe month or so. And then we should see another strong wave, similar to the one we just saw, into the summer. And that should make new highs, and that would confirm we are in this bubble phase. And again, you should see two more waves up at a minimum. And so I see the earliest peak for this would be in September. That's a 90-year anniversary to 1929 peak, which is my most powerful long-term bubble cycle. And early next year, January next year. So I'm looking for a peak in this final bubble between September at the earliest in January towards the late side, and that's when you get more cautious. And again, if I see the NASDAQ get near 10,000, I'm saying we're near the end. If I see Bitcoin 30,000, I say we're near the end. But you're also right about having diversification and a little bit of everything, because we are on unprecedented grounds here. This sort of money stimulus, throw the kitchen sink at the economy. Governments have always lowered interest rates and done certain things. We've never seen stimulus like this to fight a natural downturn and a debt deleveraging, and it's got to end bad.
I don't hear too many people even think about the thought of that ultimately currencies, these fiat money currencies, this is going to end badly. And they've done a great job putting that day off. The gold crowd has maybe been a bit early on that theme for quite some time. But, you know, there's another alternative that's not tied the cryptocurrencies. And yes, we had very frothy bubble, but still, I would just point out to folks, if you're going to have 5 or 10% of gold, wouldn't you recommend to have at least 2 or 3% in a broad basket of cryptocurrencies?
Yeah. And even scenarios between me and the crypto guys, I think I'm going to be right, obviously, because I'm looking more objectively. I would have a little bit of money in crypto because it's going to be the fastest moving, whatever happens. But if it does bubble up and we do see substantial new highs later this year, then I would tailor off of that because I think it'd be a big crash. But the opposite, what the crypto people think is that the cryptos will do the best when there is the meltdown. That did not happen in 2008. That didn't happen for gold, and I don't think it's going to happen for cryptos, but it could. But again, so I would have crypto now. And if there was a big bubble, I would lighten up on it and then rebuy if there's a crash. But if cryptos don't bubble up when everything else does, then yeah, the cryptos might be that surprise safe haven as well. And like you say, you're not sure how gold will react depending on what governments do. Some governments may just panic and start buying gold to protect their currencies. But I do remind people of one thing, and this is what the gold people, I think, missed. Just a simple thing. The U.S. dollar did not get hit in the late 2008 at the worst of crisis. It rallied 27%. So currencies were not good, but the U.S. currency ended up being the safe haven simply because they're the best house in a bad neighborhood. Nothing good about our house.
I would point out that there are several states now in our country out west that are accepting Bitcoin, and it's a growing phenomenon, you know, for state taxes, state revenues, things of that nature, just as they're also accepting silver and gold. Just as the introduction of a Bitcoin ETF led to an enormous eruption in popularity, I'm waiting for the moment when a central bank in either Moscow, Beijing, one of these other big central banks, India or Venezuela, you might recall, they've created several of their own cryptos. I'm waiting for the moment when they just say, we have a large gold and silver stockpile. We've also decided to add 1% in Bitcoin. I think at that moment, you could ignite, you might call it a gold rush, into cryptos by the central banks. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, that's a possibility. I mean, again, it's the most bubbly thing. The crypto bubble is bigger than the internet bubble. In capitalization, it's not as big, but in the height of the bubble, it's even bigger than the tulip bubble, which was financial bubble in history. So most extreme, people had no idea what a bubble was, and it just, you know, tulips were worth 1,000 times their value.
There is a competing viewpoint or vantage point. What really happened was most of the other financial markets, they were either created or for the most part by the, what do they call them, the big money lending banks and the investment banks who took their cuts. The early investor took their cut and whatnot, but the cryptos were just float out there. They were just literally put out there in the public, and that this was really one of the first times in maybe 100 years or so where there was a true retail opportunity to get in at the foundational ground level that maybe hasn't really existed since markets have been around.
There's so much going on here. My thing is that the cryptocurrencies are being used as a currency. They're being used for speculation like they were a stock at the time, which is not. So that's a reality that come to fruition here. I still say they're the last bubble, they're the greatest bubble, and they're the sign of the peaking of this bigger, the biggest bubble in history. They crash with the bubble, then it becomes the next big thing. My thing at these crypto conferences, I said, what gives cryptocurrencies and blockchain credibility to me is the fact that they've had such a big bubble. The biggest hype bubbles, like internet in the late 90s, internet was nothing in the late 90s at that point, these companies. No earnings, no sales in some cases, but they were valued at huge valuations. It's because they see them as the next big thing, just as the last big thing is peaking in a bubble. So you get this kind of weird thing. But it is a sign to me that cryptocurrencies and blockchain is the next big thing. I've been calling it Internet 2.0. It's the next S-curve of kind of financial and technology for the Internet.
I think that should be the takeaway point here. Don't we always have to emphasize, Froth, every time we bring up this topic, had quite a lot of air lit out of the tires in the last 12 months.
Yep.
But in the final analysis, I mean, look at Ethereum. It's a remarkable contract, the number two cryptocurrency. It's a brilliant legal contract, crypto assets that tie to it remarkably well. You can embed images, texts, whatever you want, right into the blockchain. And they're doing that, by the way, now with Bitcoin forks and Bitcoin as well. So I think as these use cases become more widely understood, especially by the corporate hierarchy, as well as more creative types, even the younger millennials as they adopt it, because as you say, they're not interested in even paper dollars. They're all about cryptos and instantaneous transactions. As we wrap up here, can you tell folks more, please, about your services and your latest books?
Yeah, my latest book, Zero Hour. You know, you can get that on Amazon. And the best way to keep up with us, we have a free newsletter. You just go to harrydent.com, put in your email, and you're on our free newsletter. We have other newsletters, but this is a way people can get to know us naturally. So that's what I recommend. Go to harrydent.com and just get on our free newsletter.
And lastly, we have a really loyal band of longtime listeners, Aussie listeners, and in that surrounding area. Give us an idea of maybe one or two of your favorite destinations in Australia.
Well, actually, I'm going there next week. I'm doing a tour, six-city tour from Auckland and the five major cities in Australia from the 24th of April through May 2nd. My favorite city always there has been Sydney, but I also love Perth and Brisbane, the Gold Coast up there. I haven't been to Auckland in 30 years, so I'm looking forward to that. I frankly, Chris, if I could live anywhere in the world and was not constrained by family, business, and everything else, I would live in Australia. That would be my choice, and I would vacation in Southeast Asia. I love Thailand, Indonesia, and those countries, and I wouldn't have to go halfway around the world and get screwed up with jet lag on time zones if I lived in Australia and vacationed in Southeast Asia. So I love Australia.
Harry Esnett Jr., thanks, and hang in there.
Okay.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver medals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, One Gold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. I was having a conversation this week with a retired U.S. Navy commander. We were discussing various aspects of the economic and debt situation the U.S. currently faces, and how that impacts the often referred to and ever-changing definition of the American dream. Depending on who you talk to, the American dream has evolved into more than equality of opportunity, the pursuit of happiness, freedom, and the promise of becoming better off than your parents and previous generations. Some now include home ownership, college, vacations, and other rewards or incentives as part of that definition. As we were having a lively and spirited discussion, the retired commander looked me straight in the eye and said, "Robert, do you realize nearly every aspect of what people include in their definition of the American dream is a debt instrument? Homes, college tuition, vacations, and other stuff that gets lumped into the dream that people exchange their time and lives to obtain. These are all debt instruments." And he said further, "Many of those debts never really get paid off. They just keep getting amortized over longer and longer periods until your time is up." Truer words were never spoken. A recent article on CNBC discusses how college debt for the average American age 18 to 34, how that person carries a student loan balance of $36,888, according to AgeWave's calculations of data provided by the Federal Student Aid Office and the U.S. Department of Labor. And on top of that, student loan debt is now over $1.5 trillion. And according to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, total mortgage debt is just over $15.4 trillion as of March 2019. And according to an article in TheStreet.com, the average credit card debt in 2019 is $5,331 per individual, with outstanding revolving loans totaling $1.04 trillion. because significant aspects of the American dream have in fact been transformed into debt instruments. One must ask oneself, does the relentless pursuit of debt equal the pursuit of happiness? And how much actually is enough? And most important of all, is it time to re-examine and possibly redefine your definition of the American dream? It's a question worth considering. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.